Mike O'Mara, Radio Entertainment. Inform, intelligence, irreverence, political persuasions with Mike O'Mara and Chris Frakes. And now, here's Mike.
Who picked this music? The hell is this? What's going on?
Firestarter, my brother. Firestarter. Fire and Fury.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, he's a younger man than I am. He's probably a better educated man, and he's certainly been in the real news media, which was a dream of mine when I was at American University. Garnering my degree in broadcast journalism, I used the skills learned at American University to get a job as a DJ in Annapolis, Maryland. Yes, sirree. That's my career path. But here we are. It's Political Persuasions. Mike O'Mara, Chris Frates, and we took a little break there during the holiday. Happy New Year to you, Mr. Frates.
Happy New Year to you, too. Also worth pointing out that song is at least 25 years old. It is not a new thing.
Yeah, and you know, Oscar does that to me too, Chris. So when I hear something that sounded like it was recorded 15 minutes ago and you say that, it makes me feel even older, which is always a thrill. How was your holiday season? Did you enjoy yourself?
It was very nice. Saw the family, saw the friends, did the deal, had a little time, downtime, you know, because Washington shuts down, man. Everybody runs home. It's quiet. If you want to eat at a restaurant in Washington, do it during Christmas or August. You can get a reservation anywhere. That's my pro tip.
You had a good holiday?
A great holiday. How about you, sir?
It was wonderful. I mean, I was glad to get a little downtime, a little break. Mm-hmm. And I actually tried to move away from my addiction to porn? Everything. Not porn. Thank you very much. I'll never give that up. But the fact is, I tried to move away from... I can really turn the TV off occasionally and just say... I'm circuit overload.
Do you have a TV addiction? Are you Trumpian about your television viewing habits?
I would explain it this way: that when I'm sitting in front of the magic box, more often than not, CNN or MSNBC will be on, and people are saying, "Well, of course, that's where he gets his content." Well, yeah, I do, because you know what? I'm sorry. I consider 360 on my DirecTV to be a propaganda wing of the White House, which it's become. And so, I don't watch Fox News. I certainly don't watch it as much as I used to. I used to like to tune into Fox News because I didn't think it was a complete propaganda wing. And by the way, Steve Doocy. At one point in my life, I considered a close friend when he was the feature reporter, and we went on with Steve Doocy on the old Don and Mike show. But now it just, I digest a lot. I watch a lot of CNN.
I would recommend for you, the New Yorker has a great piece this week about Fox News and the president, and it's a rip-roaring good read. Give that a look, because if you are interested in that dynamic, it just kind of deconstructs it, and it's very, very well written.
You know, it deconstructs it, but and we've got, by the way, we're going to talk about Fire and Fury, the Michael Wolff book. We're going to talk about it. Is Michael Wolff, right?
It is Michael Wolff, yeah.
I always make sure
the old Fred Armiston, as I say, like or Dr. Evil. I can't tell which one.
Dr. Evil is spot on.
$1 million.
Oh, God, somebody put him side by side, and that guy, say what you will, whatever your politics, that guy... I'm not sure he's going to win a lot of popularity contests. That's the way.
Well, and that's the thing. Nobody likes him. Like nobody in New York in the media circles likes him. Now nobody in Washington likes him. But you don't have to be liked to be a very effective journalist. That's what Michael Wolff has taught us.
You don't have to be. And we might as well dive right into this anyway. The fact is that in my brief experience over the years with print people, it would seem to me. Well, like I go back to a guy named Jeffrey York, who used to write the media column, radio column for the Washington Post, and I'm trying to think when I got laid off from CBS Radio, the guy that was it Paul Farhi, Rob, was that the name of the guy?
Yeah, Paul Farhi. Paul's still there.
And Paul, I kind of realized after my experiences with these guys that you would be naive to say that there's not an agenda. When total objectivity might be taught in journalism classrooms, but total objectivity is, I think, impossible. And I think usually my experience with print guys is there's usually an angle coming in.
Well, sure. And I mean, you need an angle to frame your story, right?
You're
kind of like, okay, well, here's what I think it's about, and so I'm going to kind of go after this. Now, the best reporters can be dissuaded of that if there's something else that they find in the reporting. But I agree with you.
They can change the angle.
They can change the angle.
But there always will be an agenda of some
kind. Well, there has to be an angle. I mean, right. Like, and critics will call it an agenda, particularly if that angle cuts against, you know, what you believe to be true. And it's like, well, I just feel like he was coming at me as a hatchet job. And, you know, sometimes reporters are. I mean, like, that's... So I think it's important, though, to separate angle and agenda. I don't think a lot of reporters have an agenda. Like, I'm going to take Michael Mara down. Like, I just don't think people think that. But I do think, I got an angle on this guy. I'm interested in this piece of, like, his story or his show. And I think that's what they're going to pursue.
It seems to me that a savvy White House, a White House that had their act together, that was not in disarray, was not in a state of chaos, as has been alleged by so many people, would probably have been a little more aware of letting a guy like this into the White House to kind of document what everything that was rolling.
I had a really good conversation on my SiriusXM show, which you can check out every Saturday on the Post channel. Shameless plug.
Where's my ding? I don't have it handy right. Ding, 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 ding.
I talked with Dana Perino, who was Bush's former press secretary this week, and she was like, I don't know why the hell they would let him in on the couch to hang out in the West Wing. That's right. Just like deadly. And as far as I could tell, he did what we like to call beat greasers in the industry, right? So you write a bunch, you're going to cover somebody, you write a bunch of, you know, fairly nice, straightforward profiles. You know, he had lauded some of Trump's moves during the campaign right after he won. He did it for Variety. He did it for, like, the Hollywood Reporter, I think.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And so, and there was, like, some Hope Hicks email traffic. So it was like, oh, we love the cover, you know, because they're big into pictures, right? And it showed him being looking very, like, winning. And so, and he said, hey, I just would love to write a book. Let me in. They were like, yeah, sure. Come on in.
All right. Let me stop you there because this is an angle. This is why I love doing this show with you, because that never entered into my mind. I know people have analyzed it. But
sure.
So you're saying to me, what's the term you used again?
Beat greaser.
Beat greasers, where you set up the big story that you want to cover, say a major tell-all book, with little pieces for magazines that are flattering so that they think you're one of the friendly guys. And then you say used a lot of pictures. But I mean, so you think that, well, it sounds like that's what this guy did to get in there, right?
And that is a tried and true strategy, right? Like, if you are, even if you're a newspaper reporter, you get a new beat and you're on a transportation beat. Well, all of a sudden, you know, you can be sure that the transportation director is going to get a new profile and, you know, all the important players, because as you're meeting them, you're saying, oh, but let me write about you. And you don't know anything that's bad yet. You're just meeting everybody. So you write these kind of positive stories and they say, oh, you know, I should talk that Freights again. He wrote that positive story. And of course, Trump is, you know, particularly blind in that spot when it's like, oh, he said great things about me. So to let this guy in and hang out on the couch. And so the way the White House is set up, Mike, right? Like, you have the briefing room, which you guys see on TV. Right behind the podium, there's a sliding door. As you walk through that sliding door, it takes you into the West Wing, and that's where the press secretary is, the deputies, and that's kind of where as far as reporters can go. And if you go back, there's a ramp that goes up and there's some other offices. He essentially was kind of hanging out in that West Wing suite. And
he had the run of the place.
It's very small. Like, you, when you go into the White House, you know, you think it's going to be this big, huge thing. Which
I would think a system of hallways, a cavernous office building where you have to walk miles down a hallway to get to the Oval Office. It's not. You're saying it's teeny.
I'm saying it's small. Like, you can, like, throw a rock and hit the president in the head. You know, like, it's like that.
Yeah, but the Secret Service will tackle you if you do that.
Yeah, I don't advise it. Don't throw a shoe either. That's not good either.
This is like two things that the beat greasers thing, and now you're telling me it's a really small room. This is why. Look, screw me. You don't need Mike O'Mara on this show. Listen to Chris Freites with these insights. I was going to be screaming and yelling about the chaos in the White House, but I'm being educated as we sit here. And this guy, Michael Wolff, is let in to the teeny, like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids version of the White House.
100%.
That's what happens.
100%. Wow. And so you're constantly, you know, McMaster's rolling by, Reince is rolling by, Bannon's rolling by. And, you know, Bannon clearly, you know, he was beefing with Jared. That was pretty clear in what he was saying, you know, and the quotes that came out that eventually ended up sinking him. he was positioning himself because he thought he had the president's favor on this and was, you know, was going after Jared, was going after Don Jr. With some of those inflammatory quotes. And the other thing is, you know, once you get him going, you know, you invite somebody in, they're around every day. They get really comfortable, right? Like you start telling them stuff because it's like, oh, well, I'm just, you know.
And you have, and Chris, you have the ego factor of Steve Bannon where, yeah, he gets comfortable and you've got an ego you can photograph from the air.
Well, think about
and you've got a guy that's just going to go on and on. Because it sounds like he was, you know, I picture him, with his nasty skin, just sitting back there with his blotchy face.
His 13 and, shirts.
And just laying back and really laying it out there and really kind of venting to this reporter. That's what it sounded like.
Right. I mean, remember, he was positioning himself as, like, you know, essentially the puppeteer, which was not a good plan. You can always be the puppeteer. Just don't let the principal know that that's what you think of yourself and that you, in fact, are doing that, which is, I think, the thing that hurt Steve Bannon the most in the early days was, you know, the SNL skits where he's at the little desk playing with the, you know, the inflatable ball and Steve Bannon as death is behind him like, sit down, little Donnie, I'll handle this. that's not where you want to be with the boss man, particularly the boss man like Donald Trump. So, I think the reporting that came out of that, you know, he talked to over 200 people and essentially, you know, Like the rest of America didn't think he was going to be president. That was the headline that kind of blew me
away. Let's get to the meat of the some of the there's so much in this book,
right.
And when you mentioned that one of the big revelations, and who know, we probably never would know what's real, true, what's not true, but one of the big things coming out of the book is that Trump didn't want to win, and no one in his campaign thought he would win. It would be a problem if we won. That's according to former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who said that.
Because he had taken $45,000 in speaking fees from the Russians and was like, why think twice? It's not a problem. It's fine.
So
everything's
fine.
Do
you buy that? And then that's kind of what I wanted to ask you today on political persuasions. I wanted to ask you what your impression of that. You know, you've been close to this. You've watched this. You've been observing this. There's so many big bombshells with the committing treason with Don Jr. But as far as Trump, let's start at the beginning.
Yes.
Do you think really, because it's been talked about even during the campaign, mm-hmm. he doesn't really want to win. He's doing this to improve his brand. What is your take on that? What do you really think about that? Because I think as much as I'll scream about Trump all day long, I think he did want to win. I don't think you go that far if you're Donald Trump unless you really want to take a legitimate shot at this. And, you know, it's a hell of a gamble to take the whole producer's angle of thing where you're setting up your Broadway play to fail. I just don't buy that.
Well, see, I think he wanted to win. I don't think he thought he would win.
I believe that.
Right?
You
could want a job and not think you're going to get it, right? Like, that would be great, but I'm not going to win. And I think that he looked at this very clear-eyed and as a businessman and said, you know what? Look at all these other Jamokes who had no brand beforehand who mm-hmm. ran and got their own television shows. Oh, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee now has a Fox show. And, you know, look at these guys who all increased their wealth, their brand, and their ability to do business by running for president. It was a legitimizing thing. You know, people go and they hearken back to the White House Correspondents' Dinner where Barack Obama poked a little fun at Donald Trump about the birth certificate stuff.
I remember seeing Trump in the audience. I remember seeing him not laughing at that material. It was this long shot of Trump, and you could almost feel his animosity towards Obama at that moment.
And that kind of encapsulates the entire existence of Donald Trump. He's a Queens boy who came across to Manhattan, wanted to be taken seriously, but was, you know, kind of new money, you know, tabloid, you know, just the opposite of kind of old New York money, always the wanting to be accepted by the establishment, but also giving the middle finger to them. And I think what he was looking for was some kind of legitimacy. Like, I'm a real important person. Donald Trump wants you to know he's important. And I think that's why he ran for president. But he was also smart enough to know, I don't think I can win, but it doesn't matter because I'll be able to get my brand out there in a way that will increase my wealth because I don't build buildings anymore. I just put my name on them. And so if I can build my name brand even more
with a political campaign, there are a few things that will get you known worldwide as quickly as running for president. He knew that. That's why I think he did it. And he promised, according to Michael Wolff's book, he promised Melania, hey, look, we're not going to win. Don't worry about it. You don't have to go to the West Wing, which is why she was crying on election night.
So the you know, there's so many things that popped out in this book. Probably the biggest story to come out of it was Bannon talking about Donald Trump Jr. meeting with the Kremlin lawyer, and you know, mentioning the comment they're going to crack Don Jr. like an egg, that Mueller's going to do that. You know what this shows? A guy that is speculating, that's bloviating. But the fact is, if you take all of the things that came out in this book and you take it into one big package, it still paints the picture that has been asserted by many other people in Washington, that this is a White House in total disarray, that this is the amateur hour, that this is the clown car, and nothing has really changed except individuals a la Lindsey Graham that suddenly play a few rounds of golf with the president. Now he changes his tune a little bit. The one thing I've heard about Donald Trump, Chris, is that he can flatter people. And I think when you're talking about politicians, it's become pretty apparent to me that if you flatter the right people, if you kiss the right butt, you're going to be able to get somebody at least temporarily in your camp. But as far as competence, I mean, every single day, even the meeting yesterday, when he brought the Democrats and Republicans in, this is a picture of a White House that appears clueless to me. They don't know what's going on. They don't know what is happening, even with players that have experience, a la McMasters and Kelly. You've got people that are just clueless. What's your take on that?
I mean, I think you're right, which is why the book was so damning in that
it
reinforced that narrative of this is a White House in chaos. But that was exactly... that is Donald Trump. That's how he ran. So I have a couple thoughts, right? Like I always hearken back to this Jeb Bush quote during the campaign where he said, Donald Trump is a chaos candidate. He will be a chaos president. The Bushes know how to run a White House. Say what you will about their politics or anything. They, you know, they are a dynasty.
It's not even a close situation with competence.
I think he was right about that. This has been a chaos presidency, but that's largely because that's the kind of organization that Donald Trump runs. And he always has. When you talk to his former associates during a campaign, they would tell you he liked pitting camps against each other. He liked to have the chaos. He liked to have you in, and whoever had his ear last, you know, had the most influence. That has been Donald Trump. Like, there's nothing here that is surprising. If you listen to him during the campaign, if you watch this campaign, I was in dozens and dozens and dozens. Too many, Mike. Too many campaign rallies.
This is the story of Chris on the campaign trail.
This is my PTSD that still exists. And like, you know, going to these campaign trails were fundamentally different than covering, you know, Obama or Romney or the other campaigns that I traveled with, Hillary Clinton's campaign. It was like a one ring circus where he was the ringmaster, and like that was kind of it. There was no infrastructure. It was a exaggerated book tour. Right. He comes in, he speaks, he leaves.
Let me interrupt you for a second, because I have limited experience with going to campaign rallies. But my take on campaign rallies, Chris, is it's not a pleasant experience for anybody involved. Probably not the candidate, probably not the people that wait 6 hours to see the candidate, and certainly not for the press corps. Now, that's with a experienced political operation. The last one that I went to, see the vice president speak up in Sarasota, Florida. That to me looked like just an unpleasant environment in general. With the disorder of that campaign that also permeates the White House to this day, did it make it even worse when you were covering Trump?
No, Donald Trump made it better.
That's interesting.
Because
he was the show.
He was the show. You were coming to a show. It reminded me of what it might have been like, you know, the Lincoln-Douglas debates back when they were like, hey, come listen to these two, like, yell at each other and drink beer, right? Like, and that, which is why, like, people forget, like, politics has been entertainment for like most of our history. Like
Look at the British Parliament.
Exactly. Absolutely. I mean, like, you know, there was almost a fight to the death on the Senate floor. You know, somebody got poked with a fire poker, right?
Would,
like,
someone,
I mean,
make it clear to the orange haired tan man that this is not the way to run a government. I think we. I've always thought we should lay a little more of that British model into
Dude, I am dying for Question Time. You know, I don't know if you're familiar, Mike, with Question Time, but every week the Prime Minister has to come in front of the House of Commons and take questions, and it's all like, would the honorable gentleman please explain to the British people how we were 13 billion pounds over budget in a plan that said it would cut costs.
And you're like, I love these guys. Right? Doesn't it make stars of some of these
absolutely.
Yeah, and parliament members?
And you know, like the opposition stands up and it's all, you know, everybody's like, yeah, yeah, boo, boo. Yeah. It's like, imagine if the president had to come down to the House. That would be
so good. We couldn't
do
worse than we're doing right now, as far as I'm concerned.
That's for sure. I agree with you there. But watching these campaign rallies, I mean, he had more people than most politicians ever bring into a room. They're more excited. I mean, he always said there were more than there was. Like, it was like, I remember being on a football stadium in Alabama during the SEC tournament. It must have been 10 or 15,000 people in this high school football stadium. A huge crowd for a politician. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, Jeb Bush would be lucky if he could get like five people in a room, right? Mm-hmm. So, and he gets there, oh, there's like 35,000 people here. You're like, oh my God, dude. Like, you don't have to make it bigger. It's already big. But people were excited to hear from him. They were pumped. And they, it was like, you know, there was hugely loud music. They partly did that so that when there's a old trick for advance in campaigns that, you know, when the candidate leaves the stage, he shakes hands and, you know, he kind of works the crowd a little bit.
Right.
They blast the music really loud so none of the cameras can pick up anything that anybody's saying back and forth to the candidate, because they might say something not cool. So that's why it's always
Hate him as well, Mr. President. You are spot on. Keep them out of here. Yes, sir. I love you. You're my God. Keep them. Build that wall and put glass shards up on top of it, Mr. President. Thank ye.
Yeah. And a little bit more. And then, you know, then
a little more colorful than that. I would imagine some of these rallies.
And then what is Trump saying back? That's the thing that, you know, they don't. So, but the music was always extra loud. People be rocking. Like, it was louder than it needed to be, right? Like, to do a live shot during a Trump rally was to like try to hear yourself, right? Like, you, just shouting. Like,
Have you read Katie Turr's book where she talks about covering the campaign?
I haven't, because I covered it with her. So I was like, well, you know, it's kind of there.
The fact of, you know, and you've lived this life of being, and it's probably more appropriate, you know, being out there and not knowing when you're going to go on, and then being camera ready and, you know, at a moment's notice having to drop. But I would imagine just being on the campaign trail can just be soul sucking.
Oh,
in a way, right?
It killed me inside. Absolutely. I mean, because because it's the same thing, right? Like, and this was a campaign that didn't have, you know, basic infrastructure. So I remember being somewhere and saying, hey, why are you guys here? And it was like, you know, that's a basic question. Oh, well, we're here because, you know, yada, yada, yada. You get no answer, right? There was no context or background. It was just he drops in, he says what he says, he leaves. So it was hard to cover them. There wasn't a lot of conversation or strategy, you know, with a lot of these candidates. There's, you know, a lot to cover because there's a whole infrastructure of aides and staff. That wasn't the case with
Trump. Apparent disorganization that you said they were better because of Trump, that they were more exciting because it was different, it wasn't something you'd seen before, but was there a perceived lack of competence as far as the way these rallies were set up with Corey Lewandowski in the early days and all that? I mean, did you notice at that point, just on the basic organizational structure, that, hey, they've got to fix this or they've got to fix that?
No, I mean, like, it wasn't that hard what they were doing.
Not that hard. They would rent a concert on.
Right, exactly. They would rent a venue. They would let people in. He would drop in. He would talk and he would drop out. Like, it wasn't that complicated. What was different was like, holy crap, man, he's all over the place. Like, you know, what thing, you know, when he was done, it was like
a message, you mean?
Yes, exactly. Like, it was like, well, what
lack thereof.
What untrue thing should I focus on in my 90-second live shot? Right? Like, okay, well, there weren't 30,000 people here, but that doesn't seem like a big deal. You know, he said that we should waterboard people again. Well, that's kind of against the Geneva Conventions. Maybe I should focus on, like, the war crimes. And,
so you wouldn't know where to dial it in because there was just
so much laid out on the table. And then, of course, the attacks against his rivals, which everybody wants to talk about, because Little Marco and, you know, Low Energy Jeb, that, like, you know, that kind of back and forth really feeds the media beast. So it was just amazing to watch all of that happen in real time. And also there was like a real underlying tension, Mike, that I've never seen in a campaign crowd before. Like people, there were definitely elements in that crowd who were, you know, excited to, you know, like push a Bernie Sanders supporter from behind, or like kind of like this low level,
or take a swing at a, right, at because, a protester.
Because he would, you know, I'll pay your legal bills, yeah, you know, get them out of here, get them out, yeah, you know, kind
hate
of the,
sells.
The taunting,
hate sells big time.
The taunting of everybody. And then like, you know, you would be talking to these voters and why are you here? You have a good conversation. Well, here's what I think about his message and, you know, yada, yada, and you have a nice conversation with the voter. And then Donald Trump would start his, you know, oh, that media back there, because we're all up on a riser, you know, behind, yeah, the crowd. They all turn around, you know, and like,
what did that feel like?
Well, I mean, he gets them so ginned up. They're scum. They're the worst people ever. I mean, some of them probably good people, but they're mostly the worst. And then here we're like, yeah, I remember talking to like this like kind of little old lady, and like she's like yelling at me, like we just talked. We were cool, right? Like, didn't, yeah, we just talk? So
it's strange. It's a strange world.
Yeah, he got them all riled up in a way where you're like, wow, like, but that's part of what drew the crowd. They knew it would be exciting. They knew,
and
it would,
he wins,
not be, and he wins,
and he wins the presidency, and here we are now. And I want to mention two words to you, because you've heard these words bandied about recently: mental acuity. This book, if it's done one thing, it's put a little spotlight on just how well is our president. And it just, you get to a point where you realize that that's just Donald being Donald. But then you say to yourself, if these allegations of, for example, how often he repeats himself, or the fact that he is not digesting the materials given to him, even a one or two page briefing memo to digest before he deals with an issue, the short attention span. So many things have been brought up about this particular president that I think cut a little deeper in the psyche of the American public than one might imagine. I mean, you think of us as, in general, a population where we love short attention span theater. But when you hear that our president of the United States is not sweating these kind of details, I think more people than just the Democrats and just people that are anti-Trump folks are concerned about this. And I know I'm incredibly concerned. When I think of that this guy is just not dealing with any of the hard work that's involved, as is alleged in this book, that scares me, especially when you're staring down at ICBMs from North Korea. It makes me very, very nervous about the state of our country right now.
Although I have to say, this whole debate over the 25th Amendment and the idea of a president who can't dispense his duties being removed by his cabinet, I think that's a really dangerous road to go down.
I also think it's not going to happen. Well, there's a chance it's going to happen.
It's not going to happen, but we also have psychiatrists who now are writing books and saying he's unfit, he's unstable.
I believe that's unethical, Chris. I don't think they should be doing
that. No, I'm with you on that one. I just feel like, you know, trying to get a hold of, and you and I have said this a lot, I'm like, well, you know, you can't put him on the couch. I can't get inside of his head. You know, when you ask, like, why the hell is he doing this thing?
When is the physical, by the way? When does he have the big,
I think it was this
physical
week. And
wasn't it supposed to be this week?
It is this week. You know,
I want to see the results of that.
I'm just sad that the White House doctor, I hope he goes back to his personal doctor, who looked like a, you know, deadheads, like, yeah, you know, like Jerry Garcia fan who, like, had, he's the fittest human ever of his age bracket in the history of the world. I was like, why? Is he like Trump's brother? Like the way he talked, it was amazing.
You've covered this. They won't be able to get around that. They won't be able to play with that too much when he goes to the Institute of Health, when he goes to Bethesda.
They'll go to Walter Reed, right?
They're not going to be able to spin that at Walter Reed. Am I right about that? I mean, you're going to have a pretty clear assessment of his health that is the public domain. I'll ask you that. Do you think they'll be able to fudge that or have fun with that at all? Or what do you think?
The assessment will be the assessment. And, you know, the only thing that they usually put out there, I mean, it depends by president, but they can decide to essentially just say, president has a clean bill of health. That's all you'd see. You know, they don't have to release.
Really?
Come
on. I was hoping for at least the cholesterol number.
They don't have to do any of that. Those are private records.
I'm pissed now. I am pissed because I was hoping that we would see the fact that, you know, his blood pressure is 460 over 400, you know, and that, you know, because, the, I mean, so we, So they are not required at the. So this is going to be. I'm going to have to, you know, rely on Sarah Huckabee to release this information,
yes.
And it's not going to. Ah, that is not cool. I thought that the fact that he was president meant that we would get that kind of release of information that we would know, especially when you're going back to the book Fire and Fury again, when it talks about the fact that they said Trump eats at McDonald's so often because he's paranoid and he's a germaphobe.
Well, see, I now know where that McDonald's, the presidential McDonald's is.
You
know,
it's New York Avenue,
right?
Isn't
on
it?
New York Avenue, right, like right down the street from the White House. So, Keith,
you think they're eating there now that everybody knows it's New York Avenue, basically because Chris Freites released that information on the last Political Persuasions that's out there. So you're telling me that when he gets the physical, that we're not going to get detailed information about unless the White House wants to release.
That's my understanding.
So we're going to have somebody come out. He's going to finish his physical, and then Sarah Huckabee Sanders, Sacco, and Vanzetti is going to come out at in the press briefing room, and she's going to say, he's fine. He's absolutely okay. He's doing great. He is Superman. He can bench press 350 pounds. That sucks. I was under the impression mistakenly that we were going to get more information on that.
I mean, usually the president's, you know, staff puts out here's what happened. Here's what they said. But that's up to the press staff. I mean, that's up to the staff. Well, it's not a public record.
Well, we'll find out a lot about it then. That means that they'll be able to do the same thing right. They've done before.
No,
you
but
know?
Mind you, like the White House is saying, we'll put a full readout on it, right? But that's it's all in their discretion, Mike. Like it is customary to do it. The White House says, "We'll, you know, he's getting an exam. We'll give you a readout of the results." But that's up to what they want to read out. It's like any private meeting, right? Like he talks to Vladimir Putin and we get a statement. They had a very productive, you know, conversation. And you hear from a bunch of sources that, like, you know, there's about to be nuclear war, right? So like that's the difference.
Well, something to look forward to. Getting back to the book, and the fact is this book has been top of mind for the last couple of weeks, and everybody's going, blah,
have you
blah,
read
blah.
The book?
And no, I have no interest in reading the book whatsoever. I really don't. The crib notes and stuff like that. You know what? If you wrote a book, Chris, I'd be much more inclined to hear your experiences like you're sharing on the campaign trail. It's the reason I read the Katie Tour book. Well, I read her because I interviewed her. But I mean, the fact is that here it is. You get the crib notes and you get the highlights of this. And it is so overexposed that I just, as far as a deep dive. And to be honest with you, it is. Reading the Kitty Kelly style books to me, that even though I'm a partisan on one particular side and I might enjoy all these allegations, I always think it's kind of a partisan exercise. I always think it's kind of a gossip book. And I'm not big into reading. Believe it or not, there's a surprise for our listening audience. I'm not a big gossip guy. I like a better, significant piece of literature that's a deep dive.
Right.
For example, presidential memoirs, I think, are more significant. My question to you about where we are with this, because I agree with you 100% that it would be a stretch when you think about the 25th Amendment, which if our listeners don't know, what we're talking about is the cabinet, including the vice president, removing a president from office because they feel like he lacks the mental capabilities discharge the office. I don't think that would happen. There's absolutely no way.
And to be clear, the 25th Amendment doesn't talk about mental acuity. It just says unable to perform their duties.
To perform his duty.
And they left it vague enough.
Under anesthesia, that's when that's been invoked.
Exactly. Or they're in a coma, right? And it's like, well, we've now decided that we need to replace him because...
Or when the president had a stroke and they replaced him with somebody who looked exactly like... Oh, that was Kevin Kline in Dave. I'm sorry. But no, the fact is that I don't think that's going to happen. So what are we left with? We're left with the Mueller investigation. And then after that, we're left with... Well, before that, the midterms... And then we're left with 2020. Yeah. And
we're left
and what's
with exactly where we started, which was the man's going to serve 4 years. That's what he was elected to do.
And I will tell you that even being on the other side politically, I think that it's getting tedious. It's getting tedious without any significant revelations. With even when you talk about the dossier that was the transcript of the information from the Senate intelligence hearing about this, when that's released, even that, it just seems like we're going round and round and round. And It is what it is. We have it. I believe the book when it comes to the competency of the White House. I believe the book with the infighting. I believe the book with the president not sweating the details and eating McDonald's. But that's what we got. And right. I don't see anything changing of any significance unless there is some amazing bombshell that comes out of the Mueller investigation. What say you, Chris Frates?
Well, I have not read Fire and Fury. I ordered it the day before it was supposed to drop on Amazon because I like a book. You know, I'm a book guy. I'm not a Kindle. I read books on Kindle. But anyway, it wasn't delivered. So instead, I read The Underground Railroad on Sunday. Good book. I recommend it. Colson Whitehead.
The actual real underground railroad slaves coming up from the right. south to the
it's
the,
a fictional okay. it's a historical fiction. It's a great book.
I love historical fiction.
It's fantastic. The Underground Railroad. So that's what I read instead of Fire and Fury because I couldn't get it, but I broke down and got it on my Kindle, so I'll read that this weekend. And when you talk about the tediousness, I think that's these investigations are really hard to digest as news and as the public, because what's happening, you know, what Mueller's doing is largely behind the scenes. And mind you, there's five investigations going on right now. You have Mueller, and then you have the House and Senate intelligence committees all doing their own. So there's four investigations in Congress. There's one by Mueller, and there aren't any bombshells, and we're not going to see any bombshells until these things are done. Like, that's kind of how this works. And part of the reason why...
And that's why it's getting tedious to me.
That's why it's getting tedious, because it's like all this small stuff, and everybody's trying to fill time with like the latest revelation. And this week it was Dianne Feinstein, the ranking member on the Senate Intelligence Committee, put out the transcript of an interview they did with a gentleman named Glenn Simpson. Glenn's a former Wall Street Journal reporter who started a essentially an opposition research shop where they do all kinds of reporting for clients to dig up dirt on their adversaries. Like, that's a cottage industry,
you know,
here.
It's funny when you say something like that because you say it so casually. And I think when you talk about going out to the rest of the world, people right. don't realize it was a little opposition research shop. I mean, this is really an organization, a man who makes his living by digging up dirt on opposing candidates. That's what they're, and they're hired, right? They're contracted.
Oh, yeah. And not just candidates, corporate clients, you know, who want to know about their competition. I mean, there is huge money in understanding, as a former reporter, and Glenn had some huge scoops at his when he was at the Wall Street Journal for 20 years. You know, he essentially applies that same. This sounds like a commercial for Fusion GPS, but like, he applies that same methodology to private clients. And so he was hired by, I think at first, some of the Republican candidates running against Trump to try
and later by the Democrats.
And later by the Democrats. Because remember, this was a thing as a reporter too. Like, he wasn't vetted. I had a binder that got passed along to me of opposition research that was probably, I don't know, 8-10 inches thick on Marco Rubio, because they knew Marco Rubio was going to run. So and mind you, Mike, like, it sounds a lot more sinister than it is. But, you know, opposition research is, here's all the votes that were taken. Here's where he said something and then did the opposite.
It's SOP, though, right?
It's standard operating procedure. Exactly.
Okay. All right.
And so there wasn't a lot of that about Trump. And so part of what Glenn did was, you know, he ended up hiring a former British intelligence agent who has his own shop, and he went to work trying to figure out, you know, well, what was Trump's connections in Russia? Because he had wanted to do business over there. Kind of what were we hearing? And that's where the dossier came from. And the reason that the dossier ended up in the hands of the FBI was that this former British spy thought there might be some national security implications, that
because he thought that one of the candidates, a la Donald Trump, was being blackmailed.
Could be blackmailed.
And
he wanted to make sure that our national security apparatus knew that. Donald Trump was saying, this is all made up, it's not true. So Feinstein ended up saying, well, look, I'm going to put out that interview that the Senate Intelligence Committee did it behind closed doors. And so she said, I'm going to put out that transcript so the American people can see what this gentleman testified in front of the Senate as to what happened, which squarely contradicts what the president said. So that's why it was done.
And that's where we are now. Because
right, exactly. But to your point, that's not like some big bombshell.
But the partisan discord is such in on the Hill now that this type of thing is going to continue to happen. I mean, you're going to get the Republicans saying we're spinning it a certain way. And in the case of Dianne Feinstein, when I'm reading the transcript, I say, well, I'm glad that she released this because I think that's how you judge this. You judge the credibility of this. And if there's someone spinning it a different way where they're shirking their responsibility to the American people, where they're trying to get to the truth and it's not going to affect national security, I think that's a good thing. But so I was all for that just because I'm a Democrat. That's not because I'm a Democrat. That's because I think that was the right thing to do, what she did. Because Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, was, I think, trying to put a lid on that. And I don't think it should have been done.
Well, I think what you saw was that's exactly Dianne Feinstein's argument, the one you just made.
I agree with it.
There's another argument that, you know, you shouldn't release all of they're doing hundreds of interviews, that you shouldn't release them all piecemeal, that you should take them all into account. You shouldn't cherry pick them, take them all into account, and then release a report that says this is our findings about how Russia meddled in the election, and it's been vetted, it's been approved by both sides. If the Democrats want to take a different view, they could write their own report, and it gets all done at one time. So that's the other argument, that you shouldn't politicize people's interviews. If you're trying to do them to get to the truth, you shouldn't then use them as a hammer to hit back at a partisan president.
Yeah, I think that what ultimately we get with this is a lot of back and forth, a lot of talking, a lot of yapping with my side, your side, but ultimately at the end of the day, it's, I know you don't, you're objective, and I've never said you had a side. I think ultimately it will come down to the big bombshells, which always gets back to Mueller, and maybe another tell-all book. Interestingly enough, we just don't flap our gums on political persuasions. A lot of people don't realize that this show is gathering so much support and so much traction right now that the newsmakers, the movers and shakers are actually participating. As a matter of fact, Michael Wolff, author of Fire and Fury, was not able to join us this week, but he did offer a taped message for us that he wanted us to play on political persuasions, because I think this show's pretty much arriving on the political scene now.
That's right.
Agree?
It's the Morning Joe of podcasts.
Yeah, we have a clip from author Michael Wolff, author of Fire and Fury.
I didn't spend 6 years in evil medical school to be called Mr. Thank you very much.
Don't mess with me. I'm one crazy mofo. I had to pop a cop because he wasn't giving me my props in Oaktown. No? I heard that somewhere.
Very well. Where do I begin?
Okay, so I'm sorry. That's I'm just doing that that shtick that we have there like this.
My father made outrageous claims, like he invented the question mark, and my mother was a web-footed prostitute named Chloe. I was put into a burlap bag and beaten when I was incident.
If you haven't seen the picture of author Michael Wolff side by side Dr. Evil, you haven't arrived on this thing.
I still like old Fred Armisen. I think have a bald old Fred Armisen appeal. Yeah,
he does have that. I have to ask you one last question about the book. With this book, after the dust settles, and it's already beginning to settle a little bit, anything out of this book that you think, outside of Steve Bannon now not having a gig at Breitbart, anything that you think will have legs, will have traction going forward? Because, I mean, when you talk about allegations of treason and you're throwing those words around, do you think anything will linger through this situation?
I think it all lingers. I think it was a big enough book and it had enough impact that we're still talking about it a week later. It is the proof that all those things you were talking about, it just helps cement that idea that it's chaos. That, you know, for instance, we got some reporting this week out of Axios that, you know, the president doesn't have a lot of structured time in his day, that he doesn't really roll up to the Oval Office till about 11 a.m. And before 11 a.m., it's executive time, Mike, which most people take to mean like you're looking at shouting at the TV and tweeting, right?
Yeah,
like,
watching the Today Show, watching MSNBC, Fox and Friends. But he watched, but apparently, I'm told, what I read, he watches all of them.
I'm sure he flips through.
Well, yeah. It's because his name is on all of them.
That's right.
He probably just can't help stand himself. That.
So
11 a.m.
So 11 a.m. and then he's rolling out of there about 4:30 for more executive time, which is, you know, fried chicken in bed while he watches more TV and calls around.
I mean,
this
is
like
true.
This is for real. Like, this is the reporting. I'm not like just being flip on that. Like that.
I know you're not being flip, and let me amplify that a little bit when I'm saying that. Here's what, you know, we say, well, it's just going to be, that's the way it's going to be. Nothing big is going to happen. We probably neglected to mention one thing big that can happen. If you have chaos and you have incompetence, what you also have in a presidency is you have national and international crises that mm-hmm. happen during these administrations. That's the part that scares me.
He's just going to have to set his alarm earlier, Mike. That's all.
You can be flip all you want, but the fact is, that is what I think we need to be mindful of. And I will ask you a question to try to relax people when I say that, because it scares the hell out of me.
Okay.
Do you think, and what I worry about, Chris, is when you read about a brain drain at the White House with people jumping off, mm-hmm. because that's when it usually happens in all administrations. You get attrition after the first year, and this is a White House that cannot afford any kind of brain drain whatsoever. And I think, do you think, I'll ask you the question, do you think we're going to see a lot of people jumping ship in the first 6 months of the new year?
Well, you asked that question to relax people. So before I answer, I want to instruct our listeners to all take a Valium. That way you'll be relaxed with my answer, which yes, we will see that brain drain. I don't see anything that suggests that there is a good outlook here. The chief of staff has asked everybody to let the White House know by, I think, Inauguration Day, the 1 year, January 20th, or at least by the end of the month, whether they're staying for the next year so that they can plan and figure out. Now, like, look, at least they're trying to get that ahead of that, to say, okay, well, if we know these folks are leaving and they've not committed, we need to backfill. But this is also an administration where there were already so many vacancies throughout the cabinet and in key cabinet positions that it's tough, man. And there's a lot of people who don't want to go in, because remember, there was like the whole loyalty test that if you weren't loyal to Donald Trump as a Republican, even though there were 17 candidates and you, mm-hmm. somebody picked a different horse, but it wasn't Trump, so you couldn't work for him. So that discarded a lot of people who were fit and could help the nation. And then
haven't been filled yet.
Right. And then you have this Russia investigation hanging over the White House. People don't want to walk into that because that's a huge legal liability. I mean, you know, everybody who's worked for Donald Trump has had to go talk to this special counsel. That costs money. I mean, those are legal fees coming out of people's pockets.
At the end of August, we're going to have Stephen Miller, and I'm not talking about the fly like an eagle guy. We're going to have Stephen Miller, the guy that looks like Fredo, and we're going to have Larry the Cable Guy that are going to be sitting in the West Wing, you know, just sitting there playing checkers, and that's who we're going to have there.
Well,
it's going to be terrifying.
Stephen Miller will be no doubt drafting some other ban of some kind or another, because he was the architect of the immigration ban.
He, by the way, is the scariest of all of them.
And
he is the Dr. Evil, in my opinion.
He's like 30 years old. He was on the Hill. He worked for Sessions when Sessions was on the Hill. And I remember, you know, Republican staffers who had worked with him telling me, like, dude, like, we didn't take him seriously. Like, he was the guy. He was the guy on, like, the group distro emails that would, like, write back to everybody with, like, his screed. Like, he was that guy in the office. You know what I mean? Like,
scary.
Well, we should be a lot tougher on that. It was like, dude, it was just an invitation to a meeting. Like, no reason to get all crazy. So, and he's like in his early 30s and he's been endued with like this power. And like, I don't know if you saw his interview with Jake Tapper on Sunday.
I did.
But like, you know,
the cut short interview.
I don't think Jake cut it short. I just think eventually it was like, dude, you're repeating yourself. I'm going to move on. Like,
yeah,
unless you're going to answer
my questions. He shut him down. And then apparently they had to escort the guy out with security. That's who, he ain't going anywhere. You know, he's not going to put his resume out. But, he's going to stay in the White House.
Yeah. But what I loved about it was like, Jake is, you know, rightfully pointing out, well, like, look, I know you're talking to one guy right now and that's the president, but could you answer my questions? And he, you know, kept talking about Donald Trump's genius. And then if to prove Jake's point, the president tweeted afterwards, like, Stephen Miller took down Jake Tapper, you know, he's a loser. Yeah. And it was like, well, I guess, you know, Jake was right. Like, it's one of those things where it was also anybody who says dynasty. You know, don't say it like that. Mm-hmm. It's a dynasty. Like with the Clinton dynasty, the Bush dynasty. Like, I don't know that. That was a little pet.
I used to have a dinner's club card. I'm sorry. We're you know, but more. What does Michael Wolff have to say about this? I'm curious about that.
My father was a relentlessly self-improving boulangerie owner from Belgium.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate that. We got to get out of here.
We do.
So you haven't made me calm. You will. Yeah, that you heard Chris Freitz. He said it. There will be a brain drain. Is that right, Chris?
I think that's right. And we have to hear from our listeners. We're reminding everybody that
we got a guy that's going to actually tell us to do that. We're going to right. Do we have that on our closing element?
We do, but I have to.
Oh, you want to do your mail segment?
I want to do my mail segment.
Oh, you didn't tell me that in the rehearsal.
I didn't.
Turn that off. Turn that off. Let's get his mail.
I care about our listeners. Okay?
I know you do. I do too.
I thought I could just slip it in once we started.
Go ahead. All right. You've received correspondence from our listeners.
I have received correspondence, and one was from a gentleman named Hardy Spire, who listened to you back in the day and informed
Hardy me. Spire sounds like a 1920s silent movie star. Hardy Spire and Fatty Arbuckle star in The Watchtower. There we go.
He's very handsome, so I mean it works.
That's lovely.
He did. I guess you did a bit with the payphones, where if you're at this payphone, and he picked up a payphone like 20
that's
years
right.
ago.
Stay on the line long time ago. Hardy must be a little long in the tooth. I would.
So I thought maybe like it made me think we probably should get a bit, you know, where we update it. For those listeners who are listening to this as a podcast, a payphone was a phone in public that you would pick up and put coins into.
That's why I'm old.
So I enjoyed that. The other piece that I got was from John Steinman, and he enjoys the fact that we work clean and we don't work blue because he listens with his kids as a way of engaging them in what's happening out there. It's another way they watch the news, they listen to the podcast. And so I think we should remember our responsibility to the children of the world, Mike, that like, God forbid, they might be getting their current events from us, which is factually true. But like, I thought that was something I never thought we would do, but I thought that was mm-hmm. pretty cool. So if you want to hit me up, tell me a story about Mike or have a question about what's going on in the world, at Freitz on the Twitters. But that's our mailbag this week.
All right, very good. And please keep the correspondence coming, and we will have a brand new Political Persuasions as the chaos continues, ladies and gentlemen. It's always something. And believe me, we could do 3 more weeks on this book, Fire and Fury, but
I require you to read it by then.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Thanks. I appreciate that. We will be back with another Political Persuasions. Chris, Happy New Year. Good to see you. And we will talk next week, my friend.
Sounds good.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Political Persuasions. If you have a comment or question for Political Persuasions, please send it to @Freitz on Twitter. That's FRATES. Thank you. You can download Political Persuasions on iTunes, MikeOMaraShow.com, Stitcher, and wherever fine podcasts are found. Mike O'Mara, Radio Entertainment.